warp journey. In their minds, they didn't have far to go. It was a purely local trip. Mule Crossing was just down the road, and Rose lived just west of the turn. But in reality, it took 2 whole hours to get there. The long, long two-lane, and then the dirt road, slower than they wanted through the infinite space, and then the rutted 4-mile driveway. The sky was the color of steel, not a threat, but a reminder. Winter was on its way. The three cowboys met them where the track came out of the woods in the final clearing. They were doing nothing, just waiting and watching, strung out in a ragged line 30 yards short of the house, like a defensive perimeter. We got kind of protective. Bramble slowed down in a no-threat kind of way and eased around to where he had parked before. Reacher unloaded the groceries and stacked them on the porch. Mackenzie carried them into the house. She closed the door behind her. The clearing went quiet. Reacher saw Bramble at the edge of the ravine. A small, neat man in a dark suit with a collar and a tie. He should have looked out of place in the wilderness, but he didn't. He looked perfectly at home. He was that kind of guy. He was thinking about something. Reacher could see it in his face. A problem. A struggle. Some kind of an ethical dilemma. Reacher was pretty sure what it was. Billy. Not yesterday's news. Tomorrow's news. Reacher walked over to where Bramble was standing. He said,
I know,
in what he hoped was a sympathetic way.
You know what? Bramble said back.
You feel bad you didn't tell the boy detective we found Rose without Billy's help.
Would you have?
No, Reacher said. Too much information. What happened in Oklahoma?
He ran a red light. The system kicked out his name and his face. Noble called him and tried to get some answers out of him. The question is why he did that. It could have been purely a courtesy on our behalf because he was sympathetic to Mrs. Mackenzie's situation. She asked him to let her know, after all. Maybe he was just going through the motions for her, or maybe not. Maybe he was getting real. Maybe he figured since he got handed Billy on a plate anyway, he might as well write up a comprehensive report. It would scratch an itch, after all. He doesn't like the Ghost Network, in which case, if he knew where Rose was, the book says his first logical move should be question her as a witness, or arrest her for buying illegal narcotics, or both. This is not the time for me to risk either outcome. Not right now. For many reasons. One of which is my client's stated preference to keep her sister out of the system. So I didn't tell him, and yes, I feel a little bad about it. I prefer not to conceal things from people like him.
Was your contract extended?
For the duration of the current crisis.
How long will that be? Bramble glanced up at the house. He said,
I'm not an expert.
How long will Billy hold out?
If Noble gets real?
Even if he doesn't, I guess. Billy could say something stupid at any time. Some little slip. The boy detective might prick up his ears. It's a big prize, don't forget. Folks who can tell the difference say what they're getting out here is the real deal. Made in America. Straight out the factory door. Whole shipments of it in the proper boxes. Which the boy detective thinks is impossible. He'll take it personally. He'll hunt it down. He'll plug the last leak. This is not the time to risk cold turkey, either. I'm sure your client's other's stated preference is to keep her sister out of the locked ward in the hospital.
Bramble glanced up at the house again. He said, I assume the kind of decisions they're making can't be made fast.
Normally, I guess not, Reacher said. But this time, they can't be made slow, either.
How long have we got?
My instinct would be get out of here within 2 or 3 days.
Until then, we should say nothing to Noble.
Easy for me, Reacher said. But you have a license from the state of Illinois.
Tell me about it.
While simultaneously having credible evidence, a man named Arthur Scorpio in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is presumably comfortably inside the Western Division, is currently coordinating a network invisible to the DEA, but that extends at least into Wyoming and Montana, and that uses some kind of last surviving loophole source like El Dorado, the discovery of which would be hailed as a major triumph and the capstone of an outstanding regional success story. I could hand it over on a plate. In fact, I have a professional obligation to do exactly that. If and when I believe a crime has been or is about to be committed. And on top of all that, I have obvious ethical obligations.
I should tell Noble everything I know.
But not yet, Reacher said.
Because the illegal supply must be allowed to continue, at least until my client arranges an alternative semi-legal supply somewhere else.
Relax, Reacher said. You're retired.
Second career.
Fewer rules than the first.
But more rules than you.
I have rules, Reacher said. I have plenty of rules. One of which says a wounded veteran gets the benefit of the doubt. But another of which says always be gone before the government arrives. So I agree. We need to thread the needle. The house stayed quiet and the door stayed closed. Reacher borrowed Bramel's phone and carried it to the head of the ravine, where it could soak up maximum signal. He dialed the number he remembered. The same woman answered.
West Point, she said. Superintendent's office. How may I help you?
This is Reacher, he said.
Hello, Major.
I need to speak with General Simpson.
Wait one, Major.
The soup came on and said, Developments? We found her, Reacher said. Condition? We have concerns, Reacher said. The Purple Heart was a severe facial wound. She has dependency issues with the painkillers we gave her in the hospital. She has no visible means of support. Can I help? At this point, only with information. I need to know which boxes she checks, in terms of her mental state, might help us with what happens next.
What information?
It was a roadside IED. I want to know more about it, specifically why she was there and who else was hurt or killed.
I'll try.
And I want to know more about Porterfield. She said it's safer if we don't. I'm not sure what that means. Who was this guy? All we know is 14 years ago, he was a brand new butterbar lieutenant who didn't make the first cut. What part of that 12 years later got him so much attention?
Sanderson must know.
I can't push for an answer. The emotional situation here is delicate.
Did you give back the ring?
She asked for a layaway until happier times ahead.
Will they come?
Maybe, Reacher said. The first part will be hardest. He gave the phone back to Bramo. Then they waited, ending up in the same places as the day before. Reacher on the porch step, Bramo on a rock at the edge of the ravine. The cowboys were all grouped together in the mouth of the track, standing around, as if they were expecting someone to show up, sometime soon. Stackley was a man who believed data and information should be put to work at once, It was rule one in the modern business environment, or maybe rule two, after ruthless control of costs. Different magazines didn't always agree. He played it safe by working both ends. Every morning, right there in his truck, before he got up, he read his overnight texts and played his voicemails. Therefore, right away that day, he knew the big guy was supposed to exit the picture. He spent his early calls working out how to do it. He was a man who believed delegation was the hallmark of a successful executive. It was rule one in the modern environment. Or two, or three, or whatever, but it was definitely up there. By the time he turned at Mule Crossing, Stackley had decided on his strategy. By the time he passed what he had learned was his predecessor Billy's place, he had decided on the bait. By the time he passed what he had learned used to be a guy named Porterfield's place, he had decided on exactly where to offer it. He drove on many miles and turned in on the next but one track on the right, ahead of what he knew from the morning before was a slow 4 miles over roots and rocks. Not good for his truck. But he was a man who believed productivity depended on the maximum use of all fixed assets. It was the number one rule in the new environment. Behind him, Reacher heard the front door open, and he stood up and turned in time to see Mackenzie step out of the house. In the shadows behind her was a small, vague figure, a silvery color. Mackenzie closed the door on it and came down the path. She glanced at the cowboys, still all the way over at the mouth of the track. She headed for Bramo, and Reacher followed. She chose a rock and sat down on it. Reacher chose one 6 feet away. Bramo used the one he had used before. They looked like three castaways on a rocky shore, making a plan. The endless plain behind them looked as wide as an ocean. Mackenzie said,
"We're making progress, I think. More than I thought we would so soon. That is, if in fact she means what she's saying. Sometimes I think she's agreeing to things far too easily, because they're about the future. She knows nothing will change today. That seems to be the limit of her horizon. But every day becomes today when you get there. She needs to take this seriously. She needs to understand the day will come when I have to move her."
"When will that be?"
Grandma asked.
"New accommodations and the right kind of doctor are the essential components. We can get those searches started immediately while we're still waiting here. As soon as tomorrow, if we want. By the way, I decided to move in. I think we all should. There are empty houses here. The drive back and forth to the hotel is ridiculous."
Bramel said,
"Move in?
More efficient, don't you think? If I'm close by all the time, I can look after her all the time. Maybe in the end we might get this done faster."
Bramel said,
"We don't know who owns this place."
"Someone who hasn't shown up for 3 years. Why would they show up now? We won't be here very long."
Bramel said,
"How long, do you think?"
"Depends entirely on the accommodations and the doctor."
"Best guess?"
"Mentally, I'm allowing a month," she said. "Worst case, 2.
Up at the head of the driveway, there was engine noise and tire scrub, and the cowboys stood back. Reacher saw a beat-up old pickup truck drive out of the woods. It had a plastic camper shell in the bed. He had seen it before, on the dirt road, driving by with a guy at the wheel, late 30s maybe, looking straight ahead, paying no attention. Mackenzie turned to see.
"This must be Stackley," she said. "Rose hoped he would come by again today."
Chapter 36 Sackley saw the cowboys step back. He recognized them from the day before, the same three guys. Partly they were moving to get out of his way, and partly to form up like a welcoming committee, or like a guard of honor. Deep down, Sackley enjoyed dealing dope. Customers were so grateful and enthusiastic, not like some jobs he had worked. Then beyond the cowboys, he saw the dusty black Toyota, right there, the actual truck he had called Scorpio about. He had described it, parked on the shoulder of the dirt road, like a cop with the two men and the woman in it, who folks said had been asking questions. One of the men was big. Stackley had called it in and had gotten his reply. He looked at the house, all quiet. The door was closed. He looked right at the far tree line. Nothing there. He looked left at the rocks near the edge of the ravine. Three people sitting on them. An old man in a suit, a pretty woman, and a very big guy. Stackley stopped his truck in the mouth of the driveway. He paused a second and then shut it down. He got out and led the eager cowboys back to the camper door, where he did something he never did. He let them see inside. He pulled back his blanket a little too far, as if carelessly, and he exposed the boxes. Dozens of them, most still shrink-wrapped, some open but still mostly full, all white and clean and printed with American writing. Behind his shoulder he felt the hum of desire, which was good. He needed his new pals to feel what he had to offer. He huddled them close, and he told them what they could do for him and what he could do for them. Delegation. Rule one in the modern environment, especially against a guy so big. Reacher saw them cluster at the back of the truck. They all looked inside, inspecting the merchandise, maybe. They seemed happy with the quality, or the quantity, or both. They reminded Reacher of his mother, a lifetime ago on a foreign base somewhere, huddling on the curb with the other army wives when the fish truck came to call. Then Stackley moved in close and started on a big discussion. The price, maybe, important to them all, in different ways. Mackenzie said,
"Rose isn't coming out of the house. I guess her friends are buying for her. Maybe they always do, which would mean Billy never saw her. He couldn't have helped us anyway."
Reacher said, "We need to talk about Billy."
"Why?"
"He's in the system now. The boy detective has already talked to him once."
"He's denying everything."
"Will he forever?"
"I assume you guys were kidding about the rubber hoses and the nightsticks."
"He'll take a deal. Or he'll cough it up by accident. He doesn't know which pieces they're missing. Sooner or later, he'll say the wrong thing. It would be prudent to assume the clock is already ticking. We might want to revisit the time scale for getting out of here. No point still being around when the supply cuts off. Definitely no point still being around when the feds show up. I know how hard this is for both of you, but those kind of problems would make it much worse."
"You don't think a month is possible?"
Reacher saw money change hands behind the truck at the mouth of the driveway. He said, "I think we should aim for a little faster." He saw small white boxes change hands in the other direction.
"How much faster?"
Mackenzie asked. "I told Mr. Bramall my instinct would be get out of here within 2 or 3 days.
"Impossible."
"How fast can you do it?" The truck started up and turned around and headed back down the driveway. The cowboys carried the small white boxes toward the house. They stacked half of them on the porch outside the front door, and they took the rest away with them down a path that curved through the trees and out of sight.
"It's about finding the right doctor," Mackenzie said. She can't live without this stuff.
Ask your neighbors back home.
They go to rehab. We need a pusher.
We're sitting ducks here, Reacher said. Some kind of trouble is coming.
Mackenzie spent another hour with her sister, and then she came out and said she was ready to go check out of the hotel. Back in 4 hours, she had promised, with her bags, ready to stay as long as it took. Grandma shrugged and finally agreed to do the same. Outside his comfort zone, but,
hey, second career.
Reacher said he was already checked out. He never paid for more than a night at a time. His toothbrush was in his pocket. He had no other luggage. All in all, he would prefer to stay in the peace and quiet and see them later. Mackenzie went back in to tell her sister the updated arrangement, and then she and Bramall drove away. Reacher sat on the porch step, already his accustomed spot. Ahead of him, the ravine widened and fell away. Beyond it, the horizon was dusty orange, with ghostly blue mountains behind it. The air was clear and silent. He watched birds of prey riding thermals and condensation trails 8 miles up, and a chipmunk on a rock 10 feet away. Then behind him, the front door opened. The chipmunk disappeared. The shared voice said,
"Major Reacher."
He stood up and turned around. She was in the doorway in her silver tracksuit top. The hood was pulled forward. She was peering out from deep inside. Shadowy scars and aluminum foil. Steady eyes. She said,
"I would like to continue yesterday's conversation."
"Which part?"
"When I thought you were here on business."
"I'm not."
"I accept that. All I want is your opinion. You might know things I don't."
"Come sit down here," he said. "It's a beautiful day."
She paused a beat, and then stepped out and crossed the porch. She was lithe and petite and moved like an athlete, which she was. The infantry was an athletic discipline. She sat on the same step as Reacher, maybe a yard apart. She smelled of soap and something astringent. The stuff on her face, he figured, under the foil. Sideways on, all he could see was the hood, pulled forward like a tunnel. The chipmunk came out again. She said,
"I told you I had a friend whose case is still open."
"Cy Porterfield," he said.
"You are here on business."
"No, but I picked things up along the way."
"How much do you know about him?"
"Very little," Reacher said. "Except he was your friend for a spell, and a rich Ivy Leaguer, and Marine, and wounded. And he liked authenticity so much he would rather catch drips in a bucket than replace his leaky roof."
"That's a fair summary."
"Also, he had 3 sealed files in the Pentagon."
"I can't talk about those."
"Then how can I give an opinion?"
"In theory," she said. "Why would an investigation just die away?"
"All kinds of reasons. Maybe it wasn't what they hoped it was. Maybe it dead-ended. Maybe it was too hard all along. I would need to know more."
"I can't tell you."
"Then let me make an educated guess. Maybe it fell between 2 stools. The Pentagon seems to have the original file. Let's say 2 years ago, Porterfield had something on his mind. Why would he call the Pentagon? That was not a natural reflex. 12 years before, he had been a combat lieutenant in the Marines. The Pentagon was never a part of his life. I bet he never even saw the place. I bet he didn't have the phone number. But he found it out and dropped a dime. which means the thing on his mind must have had some kind of high-level military aspect. Then the Pentagon copied in the DEA, which means it must also have had some kind of high-level narcotics aspect. Maybe there was miscommunication. Maybe the Pentagon thought the DEA was dealing with it, and the DEA thought the Pentagon was dealing with it. So in the end, no one dealt with it.
I can't talk about the details.
We know his house was broken into after he died.
Yes, I saw that.
I went back a few times just to walk around. Looked like an old-fashioned black bag job to me.
I agree, it was neat.
You know who it was.
I can't talk about it.
You know what was taken.
Yes.
Will you answer one question?
Depends what it is.
Just a yes or no answer. That's all I need. No details, no background. Nothing more than you want to say.
Promise?
Just a yes or no. To put my mind at rest about something.
About what?
Do you know how Porterfield died?
Yes,
she said.
I was there.
Special Agent Kirk Noble's division was based in Denver, Colorado. His office was a bland beige space, temporarily brightened up by the gold from the shoebox he had taken from Billy's house in Wyoming. It was all laid out on his desk, all in an orderly fashion. All the gold trinkets, the crosses on the chains, the earrings, the bracelets, the charms, the chokers, the fashion rings, the wedding rings, the class rings. He had to fill out an inventory form. Description and value. Some of it was junk. Some of it was pressed out of thin alloys no jeweler would have recognized. 20 cents, literally, for some of the items. Others were merely mediocre. $7 by weight for this, 9 if you were lucky for that. Other items were better. There was an 18-carat wedding band, thick and heavy. A handsome piece. $50 in a pawn shop, easy. Same for a pair of earrings. 18 carats, solid and heavy, 2 of them. Maybe $60 together. When he was finished, he looked at his list. The right-hand column. The values. They made no sense. They were completely random. From practically zero all the way to a decent wad of cash. Stopping, crucially, at every price point along the way. $2, $3, $4, all the way to more than 60, which was not how the business worked. It was not like a boutique delicatessen where you bought a pinch of this and a twist of that. You bought a $10 bag of brown powder for $10, or you didn't. Or you bought 2 for $20. Or 3 for 30, what an economist would have called stair-step pricing. Whereas Billy's pricing was notably granular, as if he was selling $5 bags and $6 bags and $13 bags and $17 and $9, full service, whatever the customer wanted, filled there and then and weighed on a scale. Highly unlikely. Therefore, perhaps he wasn't selling bags of powder at all. Perhaps his product came in bulk. Perhaps for retail purposes, the large quantities could be broken down, all the way to individual items if necessary, for folks with limited resources, or cut with scissors into halves and quarters for the truly broke, just like the old days. Impossible. He picked up his desk phone and called down to the jail. He said, "I'm expecting a transfer from Oklahoma. Name of Billy something." The voice on the phone said, "We just processed him in. Take him straight to an interview room. Tell him I have questions. I'll come down in a couple hours. Let him sweat till then.
Nothing more than you want to say, Reacher had promised. And it turned out Rose Sanderson wanted to say nothing more. Not on the subject of Porterfield, at least. She just nodded to herself, inside her hood, as if the matter was settled. Then she said,
"My sister told me you asked how it felt to be pretty."
"Yes," he said.
"You knew about me by then."
"It made sense."
"I'm sure she gave you a conflicted answer. She's still pretty. Deep down, pretty people know other people feel they're getting something for nothing. They have to be aw shucks about it. They have to say it makes them feel shallow. But now, I can tell you, it makes them feel great. It's like bringing a gun to a knife fight. Sometimes I would dial it up and just mow them down one by one. Bam, bam, bam. It's a superpower. Like clicking the phasers from stun to kill. There's no point denying it. It's a significant evolutionary advantage, like being as big as you are."
"We should have children," he said. He heard a click of foil inside the hood. A smile, he hoped. She said,
"Those days are over."
Apparently Porterfield didn't agree.
"We were friends, that's all."
"There were two dents in the bed."
"How do you know?"
"The guy who fixed his roof told the guy who told the guy who told us in a bar."
"The roofer was looking at my bed?"
"Your bed? Sounds like you agree with him."
She said,
"Cy was different."
He said,
"What would it take to fix the infection?"
"A long course of IV antibiotics. It's a common thing. Most wounds get infected. The bacteria wall themselves off. It's hard to get rid of."
"And you don't want to go to the hospital?"
"I didn't like it. I was an embarrassment. I was every soldier's worst fear, a disfiguring wound. The glamour was with the arms and legs, all that scientific technology, titanium and carbon fiber. Some of those legs cost $1 million. They looked better than new. Guys would wear shorts to show them off. Not me. I would have been a PR disaster."
"You can get IVs at home," Reacher said, "with a certain kind of doctor. Your sister will find one, the kind who will also advocate a very long, slow glide path when it comes to dependency issues, the kind who might want to maintain your current habit for at least another year while you settle in."
"I don't believe her."
"That she wants to?"
"That she can."
"She has money. This is the civilian healthcare system we're talking about here. She can get what she wants."
"People will see me. It's a suburb."
"It's Lake Forest, Illinois. You could wear a bag on your head. They'll think it's performance art. A year from now, you'll have your own show."
"I like it here better."
"Because of what Stackley brings. Before that, what Billy brought, which is a freak aberration. That trade was closed down. You're on the end of the very last leak. They're hunting for it right now. They have Billy in a cell. They're two steps away from cutting you off. Think about it tactically. We need immediate action."
She didn't reply. She just breathed a bit harder and stiffened. He felt it from a yard away, a low vibration through the wood of the step. She said,
"I'm going inside now."
He said,
"I'm sorry I upset you."
"I'll be fine. 10 minutes from now."
She stood up and stepped up on the porch, and then he heard her turn around again and wait. He looked up at her.
She looked back at him from deep inside the hood. In the movies, her eyes would have lit up red. She said,
"This is the problem. It will need to be seamless. Unfortunately, I find I need this stuff. Like, right now, the most important thing in the world to me is a new fentanyl patch. Right now, that's with 100 rings, or 12 sisters. But fortunately, I have a new fentanyl patch. I already decided to lick it. I already made that choice. Does all that upset you?"
"Yes," Reacher said. "A little bit."
"Me too," she said.
He waited 10 minutes for the hit to click in, but she didn't come out again. So he took a walk around the tree line until he saw the cowboys coming along their path toward him. The 3 guys, as always, with the one in the lizard skin boots a step in front. They said hello to Reacher in a way that made him feel they were surprised to see him. He told them he had stayed behind. The guy in the boots said,
"The others aren't here?"
"For a couple more hours," Reacher said.
"Were you talking to Rose?"
"I was," Reacher said, "as a matter of fact."
"How's she doing?"
"She said she was there when Porterfield died."
"I believe that's true."
"Where were you?"
"We were in Colorado. Spring was late down there. We got work hauling hay."
"What did she say about it when you got back?"
"She never talks about things like that."
Reacher said nothing. The 3 guys looked at one another, a little hesitant, a little momentous, as if they had just gotten a weird idea. The guy in the boots said,
"We could show you the place where he was found, if you want."
"Is it near here?" Reacher said.
"About an hour on foot, mostly uphill."
"Is it interesting?"
"The walk is interesting. As far as the argument goes, you get to judge what kind of person could have carried a body that far."
"You said anyone could have."
"I said anyone would have. There's a difference. The people who could have are a subset of the population."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Show me." They crossed the clearing near the corner of the house and headed toward another gap in the trees. But first the guy in the boots detoured to the crew cab and came back with a rifle. He said, "Right or wrong, remember why they were going. It was bear country." Chapter 37 The path rose through the woods, which thinned a little as the slope got steeper. Some trunks were scored by elk antlers. There were moose prints on the ground. No sign of bear, not yet, which Reacher was happy about. The guy's rifle was an ancient M14, a U.S. soldier's main squeeze 60 years before. A clumsy weapon, but competent. Except it was chambered for the NATO round, which was a slim little thing compared to a bear. Maybe it was all the guy had left. Maybe he had traded the rest away to pay for something that had suddenly gotten expensive. Better than nothing, Reacher thought. They walked on. The air felt thin. Reacher felt he was breathing hard. Not the 3 cowboys. They looked normal. They were used to it. At sea level, they would be dizzy with excess oxygen. Maybe better than licking a patch. The hike itself was no big deal. Roots and rocks and gravel, the same as the tracks they had been driving, but narrower. The gradient was modest. Occasionally, there were big steps up. Carrying a heavy weight would have been slow and awkward, but possible. For a subset of the population, like the guy had said. 5 minutes later, they came out on an open area where a young tree had been pushed down by a moose. There were animal tracks in and out, some of them large. The guy with the rifle said,
It was a place like this.
Like this? Reacher said. Or this place.
It's further on, but you get the picture, in case you want to turn back now.
Reacher looked left and right and onward into the trees. He wasn't sure what he expected to see. He felt a bear was unlikely. What were the odds?
I'm okay, he said. Let's keep going.
They did. The woods changed around them as they walked. The clearings stopped coming because the trees themselves thinned out, to the point where the whole vista became a kind of low-density, mixed-up, half-woods, half-clearing type of landscape. Low scrub on the ground, access lanes were clear and straight, lines of sight were long. It was good predator country. The guy with the rifle said,
"Still okay?"
Reacher looked all around. The back part of his brain was stirring. It was telling him that kind of terrain was best gotten out of, and quickly, some kind of a primitive instinct. The front part was thinking about bears. Unlikely, it was telling him. But a reality, at some low level of probability, a factor, worth taking into account, worth preparing for. In his mind, he heard General Simpson's voice on the phone from West Point.
Off post, she would have been armed at all times.
He looked all around again. There were no bears. Not there, he said.
Let's go back, the guy said.
Why?
Because I want to get back in the trees, he thought.
Out loud, he said,
I get the picture now.
And he felt he did. Stackley was the new Billy, inheritor of the whole local empire, including the periodic voicemail instructions. Stackley must have gotten a new one. Shoot the Incredible Hulk from behind a tree, all over again. Or whichever cartoon character he was by then. Message received and understood. Except, Stackley hadn't tried to execute the mission himself. He had brought in mercenary services from the outside, during the big discussion behind the camper shell. The pitch, the offer, the bait, the acceptance, maybe handshakes. He knew because of the weapon, and culture, and habit, and plain common sense. How likely was it a Wyoming cowboy would venture into legitimate bear territory without a rifle capable of shooting a bear? It was like getting dressed in the morning. Therefore, it became a logical sequence. The wrong gun meant there were no bears, which meant they were not close to where Porterfield had been found, where bears had been plausible, which meant the three guys had brought him to the wrong place for a completely different purpose. With an M14, which for sure was capable of shooting a person, or gut shooting a person. After that, they wouldn't need bears. What had the guy said in the bar with the long neck bottle?
You got hundreds of other species already lining up and licking their lips.
He looked all around. Not good. Wide gaps, slender trunks, the middle of nowhere. No witnesses, no proof. That's the whole beauty of it. For a second, he wondered how much they were getting paid, but then he dismissed the question, partly because it was inherently vain, and partly because the answer was obvious.
Far as I can tell, it's a beautiful thing. The way they talk about it, it's the best thing ever.
They were getting a couple boxes of oxycodone and fentanyl patches. Like getting offed in prison for a carton of cigarettes. Life was cheap. Then for another second he felt betrayed. He felt they had gotten along well so far. He had made an effort. He had been polite. Then he got real. He looked at it from their point of view. Some things were more important to a person. More important than family and friends and any kind of a regular, trustworthy life. No one should ever underestimate the appeal of an opiate high. He hoped they were getting a couple boxes each. They would have to earn them. He turned and walked back, keeping the guy in the corner of his eye. He wasn't too worried about the first cold shot. It would miss, snatched at, unaimed. The second shot might get complicated, and the third, and the rest. There were 20 rounds in an M14 magazine. He slowed down to keep the guy in front of him. He intended to keep him there all the way. A shot low in the back would work just as well. The round would go through and through and bury its smeared and bloody self deep in the grit 10 feet away. It would never be found. How could it? The round that killed him would be a random singularity a quarter inch wide in an uninhabited state bigger than some foreign nations. No proof. That's the whole beauty of it. He slowed again, a wordless shepherding, a polite, "After you." The guy with the rifle walked on ahead. He could afford to. They were heading back to the first clearing they had seen, where the young tree had been pushed down by the moose.
It was a place like this.
Their preferred location, presumably. Why else had they stopped there? They walked a minute downhill, some places single file, as the trees thickened up again. Richard stayed last in line, where he wanted to be. He scanned ahead and picked the spot, just in case. He said, "Let's go back a different route. I already saw this view." Which was a tactical risk. They didn't know he knew. Not yet. The time for making waves came later, not sooner. But it was a much smaller risk than arriving exactly where they wanted him. That was for damn sure. Open ground that they knew and he didn't. The guy with the rifle stopped and turned around. He said, "I don't think there is another route."
"Must be," Reacher said.
"You wouldn't want to get lost out here." "I have a pretty good sense of direction. Most days I can tell which way is up." The guy took a step. Now he was maybe 10 feet from Reacher, face to face on a narrow section of path, with the rifle held easy down by his side. The other two guys were closer, maybe 5 feet away, standing apart, so the guy with the rifle could see through the gap between. Underfoot were roots and rocks and gravel. Either side were trees. As good a place as any. Reacher took a step. He said, "This land is not where Porterfield was found."
"You're the big expert now," the guy with the rifle said.
"Sheriff Connolly conducted a thorough investigation. At a minimum, we can expect he searched every building on the land where the corpse was found. As it turns out, the only building he searched was Porterfield's. Therefore, Porterfield was found on his own land, which is about 40 miles from here, with some kind of different ecology. They have bears there." The M14's safety was a small manual catch tight in front of the trigger guard. Clicked back, it was set to safe. Flicked forward, it was set to fire. Reacher watched it carefully. So far, it was set to safe. But all four of the guy's fingers were near it. Reacher said, "Put the weapon down, and we'll talk about it. It doesn't have to be like this. Maybe we can all find a way out together." The guy said, "Ah." "Put the weapon down and we'll talk about it." The guy didn't. Reacher said, "You need to look ahead. Stackley is your best friend today, but tomorrow he could be out of business. Rose's sister is taking her to Chicago, a suburb, not the city, a nice place. She could make it a charitable foundation. You could go with her."
"We're fine here."
"They have Billy in a cell," Reacher said. "They're 2 steps from cutting you off." As soon as he said it, he knew it was dumb. They reacted like Rose Sanderson had. Sudden breathing and stiffened postures, the low hum of instant panic, plus in their case, some kind of instant urgency about what to do next, as if the glittering payday they had been promised could be snatched away. Risha saw in their faces his words, "cutting you off," translate instantly into a howling voice in their heads, screaming, "Get more, now, now, now." The guy raised the rifle, right hand to left hand to right hand, a clumsy old thing nearly 12 pounds in weight, nearly 4 feet long. His trigger finger detoured ahead of the guard. It flicked the safety catch forward. Reacher crashed into the guy nearest him and used the bounce to hurl himself against a tree, not really diving out of the way of a bullet, for such a thing was surely impossible, but it was easy enough to estimate a bullet's likely future trajectory comparatively far ahead of time and then avoid it, not forgetting that Newton's laws of motion said the same bounce that helped him also helped the other guy, but in the opposite direction, toward the gun, action and reaction, which in his case got him killed. The rifle fired, and the guy got hit and went down like he had walked into a clothesline. The roar of the shot died away to an immense, cracking mountain echo, then a whisper, then nothing. The guy with the rifle stared. Reacher peeled off his tree and smacked him in the head and took his rifle away. The guy staggered and dropped to his knees. The third guy was frozen in place. Reacher said, "Check your friend." But even from there, he could see it was hopeless. The guy had fired high, and the round had gone through his buddy's throat. Just as good as a gut shot, from the point of view of the prevailing theory. Maybe even better. The bullet would fall to earth 100 yards away. The soft tissue of the neck would be quickly consumed. Damaged vertebrae would be carried away and crushed, for the spinal cord inside. No proof at all. The guy kneeling down looked up and shook his head. Reacher pointed the rifle at him, and then at where he wanted him to go, which was next to the guy with the boots, who was struggling to his feet, steadying himself with a palm on the ground, then finally making it. "Lead on," Reacher said. "We'll go this way after all." They stumbled ahead of him, and he followed behind, carrying the rifle one-handed. They offered no resistance. They were completely passive, as if resigned to their fate, maybe in shock, maybe an addict thing, maybe a cowboy thing. They got back 2 minutes after Bramall and Mackenzie got back from checking out of the hotel. Rose Sanderson was out on the porch greeting her sister. Bramall was over by his car giving them space. The two guys and Reacher came out of the woods right in the middle and stopped, center stage. No need to tell the story. It was all right there. Two guys, not three. Both of them sheepish and beaten, driven from behind by Reacher with a rifle. Rose Sanderson seemed to recognize the rifle. Her head turned. The cuff of her hood traversed like a periscope. She stared at the scene, at the two guys, at the rifle, at Reacher. He knew she was thinking, like an infantry officer. She was running war games through her head like a chess computer. Like a West Point graduate. She found one that fit. She said, "Was it Freebies from Stackley?" He said, "Yes." "I guess that's really bad." "I'm not loving it so far." "What does Stackley have against you?"
"His boss doesn't like me."
"But you're not here on business."
"I picked things up along the way."
"What happened up there?"
"One KIA," he said. "Friendly fire. Hasty aim, a moving target, confusion in front of him."
"Let them go," she said. "Keep the rifle. It's their only remaining weapon." The two guys shuffled off down their own path, and the sisters moved to meet Reacher and Bramble at the porch step, where they all sat down to talk. Sanderson had her hood pulled forward again. It was molded into a narrow, vertical aperture. It turned and lined up with Reacher's face, and she said,
"I apologize for them."
"No need," he said. "No harm, no foul. Tactical sophistication and superior skill in maneuvering overcame an initial material deficit."
"When did you know?"
"First sign was we stopped in a clearing and they got a bit weird. But I guess the guy couldn't pull the trigger. I guess he had never done it before."
"I apologize for them," she said again. "They were my friends."
"No need," he said again.
"But I can't condemn them. You have no idea of the magnitude of what they were offered."
"I'm getting an idea, from cause and effect alone. I'm taking it seriously, believe me. I'm not judging it either. It is what it is. You got to do what you got to do, right?"
"Yes."
"Right now, what you got to do is go inside and get a brand new patch. Because after that, the next thing you got to do is make a choice."
"Between what?"
"You can have a sensible conversation about what comes next.
Or?"
"I'm moving on without you." Chapter 38 Rose Sanderson went inside to get a brand new patch, and as the door closed behind her, Bramall's cell phone rang. He checked the screen and said,
"It's Special Agent Noble from his office in Denver."
"Don't answer," Reacher said. "He's going to ask if you found Rose, either as a pleasantry in passing or because he wants her for a witness. You can't tell him where she is, not now. You'll feel bad holding out on him."
"He might have something for us."
"He hasn't retired yet. He's all take and no give. Don't answer." Bramall didn't. The call timed out and voicemail clicked in. Bramall retrieved it immediately. He listened, and he said,
"He wants to know if we found Rose."
Behind them, the door opened again, and Rose stepped out, small, lithe, graceful, with the hem of her hood leading the way. She sat down on the step. She turned her hood Reacher's way. She said,
"Obviously it's your own decision when to move on."
He said, "I'm not looking to save the world. All I wanted was to know the story, which I do now. Not a happy ending. I don't want to be here when it turns even worse. I don't want to be here while you go cold turkey in federal lockup with no medical supervision. Not even antiseptic cream, while your sister gets busted as some kind of an accessory, all because the boy detective thinks a rich white woman would balance the books on the TV news, while she goes bankrupt, fighting the bullshit charges, while Mr. Bramall loses his license and has to find a third career. I want to be gone before all that happens." She said,
"You make it sound certain to happen."
"They have Billy in a cell, and you have a dead cowboy on your land. Someone will find him, like someone found Porterfield. Sheriff Connolly will search your place, unless the boy detective has already gotten here first, thanks to Billy drawing a hand-lettered map. Unless the supply cuts off before either one of them arrives. In which case, you'll be in the ER 5 times a day with a toothache. One of those things is certain to happen."
"How long before the supply cuts off, do you think?"
"The thing that mattered most." "That's a circular argument," Reacher said. "If I move on without you, my first stop will be Rapid City, South Dakota. I need to pay Arthur Scorpio a visit. He lied to me about Porterfield, and he told 2 separate people to shoot me from behind a tree. He crossed the line, It's not going to end well for him. He's going in the tumble dryer. 2 days for me to get there and 1 day to do it. I would say that